Hello and welcome to Think Biblically Today, Easter edition. I'm your host, Tyson Thorne, and today we're going back in time, way back, to a sermon I preached at a church in Broomfield, Colorado, long ago on another Easter morning. There are some unfortunate quality issues with the recording, which I've tried to address and eliminate as much of as possible, but there is a strange hum that got into the system during the recording, for which I apologize. Hopefully it won't distract you too much from the message, the all-important message that comes to us on Easter Day.
The Resurrection. Welcome to a celebration of Jesus Christ. He loved and taught and revealed the divine. He was executed, died, and was buried, and yet He is not dead. Welcome to a celebration of victory, an empty tomb, death defeated once for all by one called the Way, the Truth, and the Life. Welcome to Easter Sunday.
Then Jesus said to them, "Tonight all of you will disapprove of me and deny knowing me, and will find in me an occasion for stumbling. For it is written, I will cut down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. And after I am raised up, I will go before you into Galilee." And Peter answered him, "Assuming that it is true that all will stumble and deny you, I will not." Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, on this night, before a rooster crows three times, you will deny me." Peter said to him, "Even if it would mean I would die with you, I will positively not deny you." In the same way, all the disciples spoke. During the post-World War II era of McCarthyism, Claude Pepper, senator from Florida, found himself on the hit list of the opposition party and was nicknamed by them Red Pepper. He found himself in a heated race to retain his Senate seat. His opponent, George Smathers, launched a campaign intended to drown Pepper in potential scandal. But Pepper was clean, and no skeletons could be found in any of Pepper's closets. So Smathers accused Pepper of the truth, claiming, "Pepper is a known extrovert, whose sister was a thespian and his brother a practicing homo sapien. While at college, Pepper matriculated and, worst of all, practiced celibacy before marriage." Naturally, rural voters were horrified. Pepper lost. It's both sad and funny at the same time. Pepper was an upright man who was the victim of a clever orator and an ignorant voter base. But sometimes the worst things happen to the best people. Take Jesus, for example. Most people wouldn't link the person of Jesus to the concept of scandal, unless they were a conspiracy theorist like Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, or an angry agnostic like Nikos Kazantzakis, author of The Last Temptation of Christ. How can the term scandalous describe a man who never sinned? The word scandalous is from the Greek word skandalon, and today often refers to a person's behavior, but in its classical nature it may also mean to offend, to make indignant, or to cause to fall away. It is this last option that applies here. In the passage we read earlier, Jesus says he will cause his disciples to fall away, or in the words of an expanded translation, to cause a person to begin to distrust and desert one whom he ought to trust and obey. So whereas in today's culture it is strictly a description of one's actions, in Jesus' time it could also describe the resulting effect, people falling away from the person they used to follow because of the scandal. We know that Jesus' prediction that the disciples would desert him in the midst of scandal proved true. As painful as that must have been for Jesus, it had been foretold long before his crucifixion. In Isaiah chapter 8, we find the following. "The Lord has given me a strong warning not to think like everyone else does. He said, don't call everything a conspiracy like they do, and don't live in dread of what frightens them. make the Lord of Heaven's armies holy in your life. He is the one you should fear. He is the one who should make you tremble. He will keep you safe. But to Israel and Judah, he will be a stone that makes people stumble, a rock that makes them fall. And for the people of Jerusalem, he will be a trap and a snare. Many will stumble and fall, never to rise again. They will be snared and captured. We see here that God, ultimate truth, causes us to stumble and fall, and often to reject God in the end. We say we want the truth, but as Colonel Nathan Jessup said in the movie A Few Good Men, we can't handle the truth. Isaiah delivered the message to the people of his day as a warning. If heeded, Israel would follow and trust Yahweh. If not, they would find God had become like a stumbling stone. He would forever be in front of them and causing them to fall over and over. It was true in Isaiah's day, but the message was to be fulfilled twice. Once for Isaiah, and once regarding the Messiah. Peter understood this and used it in his first epistle, 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 8. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by men but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, see, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone. The one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now to you who believe, this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone, and a stone that causes men to stumble, and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. And so we see the role of the Messiah is linked to the stumbling stone, the proskopto, and many would fall away on account of him, including his own disciples. Why do people fall away from Jesus, the truth, the way to everlasting life? The answer is different for every person, but this morning I want to show you just why Jesus was thought to be such a scandalous God. And because they were his own people, we should start with the Hebrews. It's easy for us to view three categories of influence: religious, political, and cultural. These three aspects of the nation's life are all heavily impacted by Jesus. In Israel, all three of these are intertwined. The whole of their state flows from the temple. Their national identity is defined by their relationship with God. Their culture, by their religious practices. So when Jesus spoke out against the religious leaders, overturned the market tables in the temple, and told people their sins were forgiven, it was a direct attack on all three aspects of the nation. In Israel, sins could only be forgiven through a blood sacrifice. Every year, the people would bring their animal offering to the temple, where it would be sacrificed on the altar by the high priest. It was a national holiday, a religious practice, and a cultural phenomenon wrapped into one enormous event. Jesus, on the other hand, heals people of their physical afflictions and tells them their sins are forgiven. Just like that. Jesus didn't even claim rabbinic authority or invoke the prophet's formula, "Thus saith the Lord." He simply forgave them. This was scandalous on two levels. First, according to Jewish tradition, even a Messiah was not imbued with the power to forgive sins. To claim the authority to forgive sins was to claim to be God. Second, if sins could be forgiven so easily, it meant the end of sacrifice, and of the temple's dominance in the life of the people. The Pharisees saw this as a blatant disregard of the covenant. Jesus understood it to be the establishment of a new covenant. This wasn't the only way in which the religious leaders accused Jesus of subverting covenant traditions. Jesus called the people to put him before every other relationship they had, saying, "He who puts mother or father before me is not worthy of me," and tells one man he called to let the dead bury their own dead, in response to the man's request to stay with his elderly parents until they died. Such importance and respect belonged only to God. And here was Jesus asking to be treated and respected as God. They had enough when Jesus began to reshape the nation. His choice of 12 disciples represented 12 new tribes of Israel. He even declared the apostles would one day become judges of the nation. In Matthew chapter 19 and Luke chapter 22. In Luke 22, Jesus says, "You have stayed with me in my time of trial. I now grant you the right to eat and drink at my table in my kingdom. And you will sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." All this culminated into a secret movement to kill Jesus. A movement that began among the nation's elite, spread insidiously and silently among the people, eventually coercing even one of the 12. They believed that by killing Jesus, they would end any belief that he could be the Messiah. To the Hebrew mind, the term crucified Messiah was contradictory. The expectation was that the Messiah would come in power, destroying the godless and the sinners and protecting the chosen people of God. Isaiah's description of the suffering servant was not part of their messianic portrait. So Jesus became a stumbling stone to the nation of Israel and a scandal too great to be permitted. Because Israel was under Roman rule, they could not execute Jesus on their own authority. So they took him before the Romans for permission. The Roman Empire had full authority to decide the life and death, including the manner of death, of all within its borders. Romans 13, verse 4 says, "The governing authorities have the right of capital punishment." Caesar used that right regularly. Rome had taken little more than a passing intrigue with a man named Jesus, but they too would soon be drawn into the scandal. What eventually persuaded Pilate to hand Jesus over was Jesus' claim to be king. As the Jewish leaders pointed out, a claim to be king was to rebel against the Roman Empire. It was tantamount to being a homegrown terrorist. So while Pontius wanted to release Jesus, he didn't want to enough, and instead handed him over to be crucified. The scandal of Jesus continued. The people of Israel demanded Jesus not simply be executed, but crucified. Crucifixion was torturous and humiliating. Romans looked on the practice with horror and disgust and refused to talk about it. A Roman citizen was not permitted to be crucified. It was a penalty reserved for barbarians. To crucify someone meant they were more than dead. They were erased from memory and from history. No historian of the ancient world paid attention to those who were crucified. Romans refused to speak of the practice, much less the people who had been thus executed. If you're having difficulty imagining people behaving this way, it's not much different from what we see in NASCAR. When a driver dies on the track, you don't see any replays on TV. In fact, no driver has ever been pronounced dead on the track. As soon as the venue closes, maintenance paints over the place where the car hit the wall. Even the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Racing Museum has no memorial, no recognition whatsoever, of the 40-plus drivers who lost their lives racing. In the words of driver Scott Goodyear, "You don't deal with it. Yet pretend it never happened." This is exactly what the religious leaders had intended: for Jesus to never be spoken of again, for him to be forgotten, erased from the human record. But the scandal didn't end. It grew. Following the resurrection, more and more people began to openly discuss Jesus. The first implication to the Romans was that among the empire's executed and forgotten criminals was the Son of God. Despite the highly religious nature of Rome, if one wanted to know God and understand his will, you didn't need to visit one of the thousands of temples or sacred gardens around the empire, or even consult one of their great philosophers. Instead, one visited a cross just outside the gates of Jerusalem. If this wasn't enough, the second implication was even more terrible. This crucified criminal was someone whom Caesar himself would one day bow before. Scandal beyond imagining. We see now just how the Messiah, Jesus, the sinless sacrifice, became the greatest scandal the world has ever known, and still knows. What is it about Jesus that continues to be scandalous? For starters, Jesus threatens every world religion. You may have heard that Christianity is the only faith where God reaches down to man, rather than man attempting to reach up to God. This is true, but only touches the surface of the scandal. Religion attempts to free people from the shackles of their humanness. The best demonstration of this is by Deepak Chopra. Chopra is from India, as you'll be able to tell from his accent, and has authored many books, his latest of which is Jesus, A Story of Enlightenment. He is not a Christian and follows an Eastern approach to life and religion. Highly respected, Chopra has been on Larry King Live, Fox News, and many other networks, and is a contributor to the Huffington Post. Here's what he has to say. Chopra and many others believe that it is our humanness that keeps us earthbound and hinders us from transcending to the next plane of existence. But Jesus shows that God has chosen to entangle himself with humanity. God chose to become a part of our lives, to become a part of our frailty, our pain, our confusion. In so doing, he gave dignity and significance to humanity. He showed us that as we draw near to him, we become more human, not less. Jesus is also the antagonist of humanism. The philosophy that has won the minds of the West believes that humanity is morally good and becoming better with every passing generation. It attempts to free us from the bondage of a belief in God and encourages us to become better, either through personal morality or an evolution of consciousness. Jesus threatens such concepts by revealing our sinful nature and our downward spiral into depravity. He alone holds back the greatest of evil that we are capable of, and he alone is the answer to man's problem. The truth about Jesus and his teachings subvert humanism and other modern philosophies, as well as modern institutions our culture prides itself on, including education and the sciences. Well, since Deepak Chopra is from India, I thought we might have a look at from another very intelligent man from the same part of the world. Dr. Vinoth Ramachandra is a believer. He's a rocket scientist, primarily, and is from Sri Lanka. Ramachandra says this about our condition. The message of Jesus tells us that God takes us as we are, with all our brokenness and fears, our failings and inadequacies, our families, cultures, and occupations. We don't have to make or change ourselves to be loved by God. But even though God accepts us as we are, he doesn't leave us where we are. We are more human than human. We are the people of God. In nearly every conceivable way, we live in opposition to this world. Like Jesus, we are opposed to its religions, its philosophies, its ways of life. We find joy in being slaves of Christ, and even when we experience the pain of our sin and the sins of others, we have hope, purpose, and most importantly of all, we have God. We are a part of the scandal of Jesus.